This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
To be completely untrue, because of course the moment that the book came into the world, the very first question on everyone's mind was exactly what you just said, which is, can this happen in America? Do people live like that? Is that possible? And I realized at that point that it was an important part of the message of my book to stand up and say, actually, yes, they do. And yes, we did. We lived exactly like that. So, of course, the book is a work of fiction, but the apartment in the book, the factory, those descriptions are all completely true. And it was hard to write about them, but it was necessary as well. And I think that's why I did it.
I was curious, since your book was published in 2010 till now, especially here at the PCC campus for this big PCC Reads initiative, how have people responded to your experiences and your writing?
Oh, in the most wonderful way. So I've been so lucky because so many people have written me or come up to me to say, I understand this book because I can identify with it. And not just people who are immigrants, but people who have experienced that feeling of being an outsider or of having overcome difficulties. And I think that's you know, why the book speaks to people. And it's the best thing in the world when I hear it, because it makes me feel like, well, that was really why I wanted to write that book. And I'm so thrilled that it touched somebody who was maybe in a position similar to that of mine, or maybe the daughter of someone like that, or, you know, the friend, and not just Chinese immigrants, but also, you know, Italian, German, all types, and also even people like, you know, someone who is deaf came up to me and said, oh, it captures so well that feeling of being on the other side.
And that's a good segue into my next question, that you were experiencing basically having a double life, being a child of an immigrant and having to hide what you're experiencing at school from your mother, and similarly hiding what you experience at home and in the factory from your school life, especially at the prep school stage. Talk about that experience that entire population you were just describing, these people will deal with.
I think that growing up with a foot in different worlds is something that a lot of people can identify with. And it is, it's difficult. You know, when I was growing up, I never told any of my friends about my real life, you know, about where we came from or how poor we were, because, you know, I wanted to leave it behind us. And I had told a friend or two when I was much younger, and they didn't believe me. You know, they'd ask their parents, and then the parents would come back and say, no. No one lives like that in America. Kids don't work in factories in America. And so I think that, you know, that was difficult. And then when my book came out, I know someone said to me, you know, he said, thank goodness you wrote this, because I have tried to tell my wife what my life was like when I worked in a factory, but she couldn't really understand it until she read the book, what that was like from moment to moment. And yes, your two lives become very separate because you don't know how to bridge that gap. You know, you don't know how to tell people, well, that's where I came from, because it seems so different from what everyone else goes through. And I guess I've realized for myself in the process of having this book be published and be, you know, so well received, that actually so many people have secret lives like that. And it's a wonderful thing when we can begin to have a dialogue about it.
There are two things that I noticed in the book. Speaking of language, the way from Kimberly's perspective, how she would hear what people are saying and it was misunderstood, and similarly using the Cantonese idioms as they are translated into English. So talk about how you played with language in the book.
Yeah, that was something really important to me, the use of language in the book, because what I hoped when I wrote the book was that I hoped to have the reader undergo the experience of being an immigrant. I didn't want them to hear about it. I wanted them to really feel what it's like to be on the other side of that language barrier. And so that's partly also the reason that I wrote the book as fiction, so that I could play with those things. And I thought, you know, as somebody who has grown up bilingual, I know that I don't really translate from one language to another. It's really that information comes in and I send it out in whichever language is appropriate. So I thought, well, that's actually how the book has to be written. When Kimberly hears Chinese, which is her language at the beginning, she hears it fluently, and that makes us and the readers fluent in Chinese as well. So when they use Cantonese idioms like, oh, it's like picking up a dead chicken, that means, actually, that's a great thing, because it means there's a chicken dinner lying for you free at your feet, you know, that the non-Chinese reader can experience that. But more importantly, that when Kimberly is learning English and she hears somebody say something, it sounds to her like blah, 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 word I understand, blah, 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 blah. So because of that, Kimberly hears English, and then parts of that are gibberish, and parts of that are words she can understand. And that allows us as the reader to know what it's like to need to respond, to need to react, and yet not be able to, because we did not understand what was being said to us.
Yeah, that is a really important point that, well, hopefully a lot of educators and students took away from this book. Have you gotten any responses from educators?
Oh, so many. Yeah, so many. Because the book has been chosen for many common reads in a lot of colleges and universities, and has also been adopted in many high schools. In fact, Primary Source has created an entire teacher's toolkit around the book with homework and exercises and video and history. There's a link to it on my website. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's incredibly important to me, because I love the fact that educators are using the book to reach students who might not, you know, be accessed otherwise. And I've heard also teachers say to me, I think I'm a better teacher having read the book, because I understand more the limitations that a child may be facing but is afraid to tell me.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm guest host Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to an interview with award-winning author Jean Kwok. She's the author of Girl in Translation, and this book, while a work of fiction, illustrates the secret double life of Jean Kwok's childhood in Brooklyn. And there's one other, well, there were two other points about how a child might view the world, such as counting the material cost of things in the number of skirts. And another incident where Kimberly has to take current events quizzes, which is a perfectly valid and good educational tool, but the teacher just assumed that everybody has access to the New York Times. Talk about that experience.
Well, I think that's such an astute question, because it's one of the traumas of my youth, was that we had those current events quizzes. And I was good at school. You know, I was lucky to have a gift for school like Kimberly, and that was my way out of that life. But there were things that I could not compensate for. And one of them was the daily current events quiz, because exactly like her, I had no access to an English newspaper. I was at the factory until late in the night. I couldn't listen to the radio, couldn't watch TV. The thing is, I should have told my teacher, but I didn't. And I think that the child I was at that age just did not have it within her capabilities to open her mouth and tell her teacher the truth of her situation, and I didn't. But it didn't occur to the teacher that it was impossible, you know, for somebody in her class to do that. And so I failed them. I just failed them every single day. And it, you know, I mean, when I was younger, exercises like, you know, make a collage with old magazines in your house. You know, we had no magazines. I mean, I didn't have glue. I didn't have markers. I didn't have all of that stuff. But I wasn't going to tell anyone because, you know, I was embarrassed about it. And I think that's a difficulty that a lot of working class people have.
Absolutely. Well, and speaking of that, the same double life question with respect for authority, whether it was teachers or your mother or Kimberly's mother or Aunt Paula, and how to negotiate the world between how we stand up for ourselves and how we respect elders and then protect ourselves at the same time.
It is really difficult. And I think that balance is kind of at the heart of being in a diverse society like the one that we live in. That, you know, I think from the parents' point of view, it's really difficult to let the children go because they've already let them go so much. You know, they've already gone so far in terms of how they feel, but it's never as far as the child wants. You know, the child always wants more freedom, more ability to make their own choices, all of those things. And I mean, I think a part of the reason I wrote the book was that I also hoped to tell Kimberly's mother's story, to let people know that this is what a first generation immigrant goes through, and these are the sacrifices that she has made for you, and that she, you know, I think immigrants sacrifice everything, their education, their degrees, their wealth, their friends, their family, for their children and their future, and that is something that we as the children need to value. But on the other hand, we also have the right to live our own lives. And I think that that is essential, and to make our own decisions. I think that at the basis of what we choose needs to be love, so that we love and respect each other and love and respect the other generation. But in the end, I do believe your life is your own, and it is your right to live your life as you see fit. And sometimes that means making decisions that someone you love won't agree with. And I think in my own life, I've had to do that as well. And I try to make sure I'm making the right decision, a good decision, not a stupid decision. I try to avoid those. But, you know, if I'm doing the best I can, that's really all I can do.
Yeah, it's a struggle for all of us who are children of immigrants. I will definitely attest to that. Switching gears a little bit, you actually live in Holland. So you've made a very long trek to Portland, and we greatly appreciate it. First, what brought you there as your second immigration?
Right. I know. It's like as if one immigrant experience was not enough, I have to have a second one. And basically what happened was I met a Dutch guy. We fell in love, and just practically, I was a writer and a teacher, so it was just easier for me to go to Holland than for him to come to the U.S. And, you know, you make these decisions thinking, oh, well, we'll see. But before you know it, you've built up a whole life there. So now we're married and we have two kids. And yes, I live in Holland. I grew up in New York, but I live in Holland. So I did go through the immigration experience twice. And I will say that it was really, it's always difficult. I mean, it's always difficult to be an immigrant. What I've learned from being an immigrant is that learning the language is essential. And that was the very first thing I did when I moved to Holland, was that I made sure I learned Dutch as well and as quickly as I could. But I will say that the first time moving from a non-Western language and culture to a Western one was huge. And the second move from the U.S. to Holland was also difficult and filled with misadventures, but it was much easier. It was just much easier. I had a diploma from Harvard and from Columbia in my suitcase when I moved, and that made all the difference. But yeah, it is, you know, I mean, at this point, I feel comfortable in all of the different societies I navigate. But it's taken a lot of time, and I've certainly done a lot of things wrong or been shocked that things are done differently here or there. I think the thing I've realized is that even though it is very hard when you have a diverse background, because you always have to choose in every situation what you're going to do, that's a great gift as well, because then you know there is a choice, and that allows you to very consciously choose your own path.
Wonderful. I just cannot fathom how you had a life working in sweatshops and having to protect your mother from other issues and living the life you had in that apartment, and then going to a prep school, and then going to Harvard. And talk about that transition.
I think when you come from difficult circumstances, what you learn is that if you don't do something to change your life, your life won't change. It's that simple. It's not, maybe in a way I was lucky. You know, it wasn't like I had yuppie parents who were like, oh, go practice your piano lessons, you know. And I could rebel against that or something. I did not have that. I didn't have piano lessons. I didn't have any lessons. And it was very clear to me that if I just kind of coasted in my life, I would work in the factory my entire life. And I would live in an apartment like the one we lived in my entire life. And the only way that I was going to escape that was by myself and with my own efforts. So that made my life very clear. And it was difficult because I'd get picked up after school by my father, and I'd work at the factory until like 10 at night, and we wouldn't get home till 11. You know, I was 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old. I mean, I was little and I was tired, and I had homework, I had tests, I had projects, I had all these things I had to do. Did everything on the subway or at the factory during breaks. But I knew from very young that school was going to be my way out, because that was where I had an ability. That was where I could do it. And it was clear to me that I was the only one who was going to be able to make my life different.
And what about relating to your peers and your teachers in those settings?
It was very hard because nobody knew what I had at home. You know, nobody knew what my life was really like. So I had to lie to kind of get around it, or I would do weird things like, you know, we would have to hand in a diorama and mine would be like completely pathetic when I brought it in because there was no glue, there were no markers, there was none of that stuff. So, you know, it's just kind of constant compensation to hide my situation. It was difficult. But on the other hand, you know, I loved my friends and I loved my teachers. And, you know, they kind of showed me another world and another way of being, and showed me books, I mean, knowledge. I learned so many things, and that kind of was a doorway that I wanted to step through. And that gave me the motivation to do what I needed to do and to work as hard as I needed to work and to sleep as little as I needed to sleep to get everything done so that I could leave that life.
Kind of political question. With your life and the background that you had, and then we have this other issue that's in the Supreme Court right now, which is about affirmative action. And Asian Americans are pitted on both sides of this issue for a lot of stereotypical reasons. Do you have any opinions about this?
I think that, Asian Americans have been successful in general, and that's something that is, you know, fantastic. And I think that, you know, you go to a school, maybe a top school, and you see a lot of Asians there, and, you know, people have this idea that, oh gosh, they all have it easy, they're all out, they're all this, but it's really not true. I mean, and I know from having come from a working class background, having worked in a factory and knowing working class Chinatown, that for every single successful Asian that we see, there are 100 that are left behind. And at the factory, for example, you can start working there as a child. I did, and I was not at all the only child there. You work there through your teens until you are a young person, and that's your, you know, the peak of your speed. And then as you start to slow down, you can keep working there until you're 80. And then you work there basically until you die. And there are so many people who stay in that cycle. And I think I was really lucky because my ability was in school. But, you know, I mean, at home, I was actually a disaster. And I was like this terrible Chinese daughter because I'm really clumsy and I burn food and a lot of other stuff. And I was argumentative and stubborn. And so at home, I was like this disaster. But sometimes I think that if my skills had been inverted, you know, if I had been good at cooking and cleaning and bad at school, I would probably be like working in a restaurant somewhere. You know, I would be a dishwasher or a waitress or something like that. So I do think that, you know, it is important to provide support for people in need, and, you know, regardless of color.
Well, thank you so much, Jean Kwok, for chatting with me on KBOO.
Thank you, and I've really so enjoyed being here.
That was award-winning author Jean Kwok, the featured author for this year's PCC Reads initiative. Her debut novel, Girl in Translation, became a New York Times bestseller, among many other accolades. This story is a work of fiction about a girl whose immigrant life became a secret double life. You can keep up with Jean Kwok at her website, jeankwok.com, or find her on Facebook at Jean Kwok Author. This has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sari Gametta. Thanks for listening.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
In celebration of Foster Care Awareness Month, KBOO Community Radio and Boys and Girls Aid present two screenings of the documentary From Place to Place. The film follows the lives of three teens as they age out of the foster care system and then try to change the system that failed them. Following the film, there will be a panel discussion with former foster children from Oregon. The screenings will take place in Portland, May 16th at the Q Center, 4115 North Mississippi, and May 23rd at the Oregon Foster Youth Connection Resource Center, 1209 Southeast Belmont. Again, that's two screenings of the film From Place to Place, May 16th and 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Five years ago this week, the Columbia River flooded into the largest public housing project in the U.S. at the time, leaving 18,000 black people homeless and changing race relations in Portland forever. On Friday, May 24th, from 8 a.m. to noon, KBOO presents a special program on the Vanport Flood and racism in Portland, 65 years later. We'll feature historians and archived audio, as well as a discussion led by PSU professor and activist Walida Imarisha, asking why there's so few black people in Oregon. That's Friday, May 24th, from 8 a.m. to noon on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Also, thanks to a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
Thank you. Hello, and welcome to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. And if you're wondering how to spend this rainy holiday weekend here in Oregon, we'll be talking today with members of our local film community who are putting on some one-of-a-kind events.
A little bit later in the show, we'll be joined by Hannah Piper Burns, co-curator of the Experimental Film Festival Portland, which is going on right now. She'll be joined by visiting filmmaker Kenny Reed, who's in town from Chicago. Kenny will be screening some of his own works and also leading some workshops on do-it-yourself animation.
But first, we're joined today by Eric Isaacson, one of the founders of local record shop and music label, Mississippi Records. He'll be introducing a world premiere screening at the Hollywood Theater this Monday, May 27th, entitled I'm Not at Home in This World Anymore, featuring rare archival footage of folk, blues, gospel, and unclassifiable American music. He's live in the studio with us now. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So before we get into the screening, can you give a little bit of background on how Mississippi Records came about and what your mission is as a label?
Sure. So Mississippi started as a store here in Portland. I started it, to be perfectly honest, because I couldn't find a job, as many of you know this dilemma in Portland. And so I just decided to throw together a record store, pretty haphazard. And then gradually, we moved into forming a record label about 2 years into the operation. And the record label was mainly, it was first created just to fill gaps that weren't being covered by other record labels. I was just noticing a lot of things that weren't being given proper due attention to archiving. And so I got into the game that way, but quickly it became sort of a bit of a religious mission to just get as much of this out there as I could, and it got a little obsessive and strange, and now we have 155 records on our label at this point, 10 years later.
10 years, wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So as far as the material that's going to be featured in your screening, I understand some of this is coming from Mississippi Records' own archives. How has your label gone about building an archive of film footage in addition to musical recordings?
Very accidentally. It was, we work a lot with directly with a lot of artists and their ancestors, and, they're constantly sending us whatever they can find around the house, a photo here, a reel-to-reel there, a cassette tape, whatever we can get to make artwork for the records or music, occasionally we would get a piece of film from one of these artists or their families, and sometimes we'd even lift audio from these films to make records out of, because it would be the only existing version of the song would be on a film, not on any other kind of recording. So, it was just piecemeal over the last few years. We've been throwing together all these little bits and pieces.
And other footage, I understand, is courtesy of the Alan Lomax Archives. In reference to the renowned American folklorist and field collector of folk music, can you talk a little bit about his work and his American Patchwork video collection that I think you're referencing?
Yeah. Well, Lomax started doing recordings in the 40s. He didn't get into film until 1978 or so. He did a little bit of film in Haiti and stuff like that, experimented with it, but it wasn't his main bag. And a lot of that was because the technology hadn't caught up with his needs. He was very on the go, and he couldn't be carrying around a bunch of clunky equipment. So he just never really approached it until the first commercially available video cameras came on the market. So he got those in 1978. There was something called the U-Matic camera, which was this bulky, weird predecessor to the home video camera, VHS camera. And so he saw in this new technology, he was really excited about it because it was so portable and cheap, and he had no budget at all, but he decided that film was a much better way to document all the things, a much more total way than just the music or, the endless. He would always take endless notation, endless interviews, and do a music recording. But film, he could sort of get it all in one shot. So he, from 1978 to 86, he was traveling around the country using this U-Matic camera to, at first he had all kinds of crazy plans for it. A lot of it was to just make. He actually started out with the ambitious idea of starting a project that would take a full generation, like, you know, 40 years of recording every piece of human culture on film before it disappeared, all the endangered cultures, all of the cultures that the mass media was going to bulldoze over in time. You know, he'd been watching since the 40s the deterioration of vernacular cultures in America, like little pockets of individual culture become a monoculture, and this terrified him, you know? He considered this a great, great disaster. So his idea was, well, before it all disappears, I'm at least going to make some film of all this and sock it away. So one day when people see how insane this is, somebody can pull this film out and say, hey, look at how diverse the world could be and beautiful. You don't have to just have the corporate masters determine all your entertainment, you know? It doesn't have to be Hollywood and television and radio, like commercial radio, that determines everything you see and hear. So he started on this ambitious project, and he made a couple PBS specials out of it, but they were largely ignored. They weren't very well made, to be perfectly honest. The footage was amazing, but the overall production value was pretty shabby, and he wasn't on his game as much for that for some reason. So the footage just got shoved aside, and there's 300 hours of this footage that's been moldering for since the 80s.
Wow. And how did you dive into that? How did you make selections to be featured in this screening out of 300 hours?
I took an edit of an edit. So the people at the Alan Lomax Archive have been slowly going through all this footage and, posting a lot of it on YouTube. That's because their mission is just to make everything free to everyone. That's their thing. They don't really approach it from an art angle, like we want to make, films or even records like I do that for them. They're more about the idea of making sure this important cultural information is available to the cultures from that sprang it, so that's their main mission. So they've been sort of whittling stuff out and showing it to me piecemeal over the last couple of years. We've been working slowly on making a bunch of record sets out of lifting audio from these. But as I was seeing little pieces of this film, it was blowing my mind, and I was like, I can't believe this exists, because in 1978 to 86, barely anybody was documenting, or nobody really was documenting folk culture in America at all. You know, it just wasn't done. It was the age of like Thriller and, the big mega hit, and nobody cared about